is March 10th, 1982. So expert witness, this you're adding to your curriculum vitae on page 3, saying that you were in around 1970 an expert witness in a lawsuit against Texas.
A lawsuit brought against Texas Gulf Sulphur by Leach Gold Mines in the Supreme Court of Ontario. And I was an expert witness on the behalf of Texas Gulf Sulphur. Incidentally, Texas Gulf Sulphur won.
Oh, that's comforting.
The other is more recent and has been going on for the last 2 years in a case involving the boundary between Georgia and South Carolina in the lower Savannah River. The case brought by Georgia against South Carolina before the Supreme Court of the United States. I was an expert witness on the side of South Carolina.
How did you decide which side to be on?
Well, they asked you. No, I didn't have anything to say about it. South Carolina came to me and said, would you? I was an expert witness in physical geography, cartography, and the history of cartography. It was a very interesting and complex case, which has not yet been decided by the Supreme Court. Hmm. Okay, those two things didn't get added onto that. Well, the other two things that occurred to me that you might be interested in terms of my activities here at the university were that, again, I can't tell you what the dates are, perhaps it's in the curriculum vitae. I was for several years chairman of the Committee on Student Conduct and Appeals at the university. Mm-hmm. This was at a time when that committee had very considerable authority, and at a time when the deans of the colleges, the student deans, had very much authority over the activities of the students in their colleges, from a disciplinary point of view. And the function of the Committee on Student Conduct and Appeals was to hear appeals from students who had been disciplined by the deans, but felt that it was unfair.
What year did you say? What years?
I didn't say because I can't remember. Can I?
Is it in here?
Well, it probably is, but I won't guarantee it. No, it wouldn't be. No, it wouldn't be in there.
It'll be on.
Well, it should be on a record, yeah. It was while Ted Zillman was still dean of men. I can tell you.
So that's quite a while ago.
That's quite a while ago, yeah.
Did he precede Kaufman as the?
Oh yes, yeah. It must have been around the late 50s or something like that, because I was moved off the chairmanship of that committee and put on the athletic board. I was on the athletic board for quite some time, but I got off of that in 1964.
Okay.
Well, it was a time in the transition of the university when the university was changing from the in loco parentis kind of situation vis-à-vis the students and the university to the present day situation, which is certainly not in loco parentis. And we had all sorts of cases before us of students who were stealing and who had been accused of stealing and cheating and practically anything you can think of. One of the most interesting cases was a student who got into some trouble in an apartment building by making a lot of noise, and a doctor who lived in the apartment building got upset by it and accused the student of starting a fight with him. And my job as the chairman was to do a lot of investigating, because we didn't have investigators or anything like that. So I went around and did a lot of interviewing and so on to find out whether this really was the case or not, because the doctor was insisting on this kid get thrown out of school. And he was a senior and all this sort of stuff. And so I finally thought that there was reasonable doubt as to who was telling what on this. And so we arranged to have a lie detector test by the state crime laboratory, unbeknownst to the doctor. And the student passed with flying colors. Turns out that a few years later, the doctor became my doctor, and has been, was until, well, was for 15, 20 years. He never knew that I was involved in this.
I should have thought you'd have thought twice before having him as your doctor.
No, he's a pretty good doctor. I thought he was a very good doctor. But at any rate, it was a very interesting time, because we were just changing over at that time to having our fingers in everything that the students did to now, when we have very little. And I look back on it as an example of what a tremendous control the university did have over the students. At that time. And the way the students were battling to try to get that control eased. But they weren't very good about it. One of the things they tried and tried and tried to do was to get us to make a list of the things they couldn't do. and of course, we wouldn't do that. That's a crazy sort of thing to do. And but they were up in arms about it. They just kept after us. How can we know what we're supposed not to do unless you tell us? You know. And but it was a very onerous job. It took many, many, many hours, and there was no administrative help in the way of any secretary or anything like that. I had to keep all the files and all this sort of thing. It was really a horrid job, but it was, I guess, a necessary one at the time. I think we're better off without it.
Well, certainly wouldn't be any reinstating it. Question about that, the veterans were still around campus in the early 50s.
This was after the early 50s.
Oh, it was.
Yeah. I don't remember ever having a veteran in front of the...
Yeah, because they would have taken exception to being...
It was mostly involved with cases of stealing those kids would go out and swipe a bunch of tires from a gas station girls, for example, not coming in when they were supposed to, and lying about it, and this sort of thing. Things that we wouldn't even think of doing today. but there was a lot of it, and the deans were pretty rough, and they laid down these rules, I mean, not rules, but these penalties and decisions, and I thought they were pretty stiff. We had a good committee, and we frequently overruled the deans.
Oh, that's right. You said you were dealing with Zillman.
Well, he was...
He was the dean of students.
He was the dean of men at the time.
Of men,
yeah.
Yes.
But we had the dean of men and the dean of women, but we also had the student deans in the... I mean, the student affairs deans in the college.
Mm-hmm.
Handles the honors program?
Rudisilli.
Rudisilli. Mm-hmm. Chet Rudisilli was the dean of students at that time. And he was involved in this for anybody in L&S who was involved in anything having to do with the academic side of the thing. Zillman was having to do with people who broke the law or things like this.
I've heard that. I'm trying to remember what I have heard about him. I know he's been criticized. People have been very critical of him. Whether he was rigid or... And I don't remember.
You mean Ted Zillman?
Hmm.
Well, my own view is that he wasn't particularly rigid relative to the mores of the time. We didn't find him that way at all. If we looked at him now in terms of what we think of now, we would think it was unbelievable. But this was normal at the time. It wouldn't make any difference whether you're Wisconsin or Lawrence or Beloit or anywhere else. Same thing was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And it had been even more so when I went to school. It was just the change that was occurring. This was sort of the last gasp of the thing. Now, I don't even know whether there's still a student conduct and appeals committee. I haven't the slightest idea.
I don't know either.
Yeah. I don't see much reason for one. But at any rate, it was a rather significant part of the university at that time, as far as the students were concerned, because lots of students were getting disciplined in lots and lots of ways. The university felt that it had the authority and the responsibility to discipline, as well as something that a student might be disciplined as far as the law was concerned. If they stole, well, the law would get them. But the university thought it ought to also. And not only would they get fined for doing something, for example, but they might get heaved out of the university for the same reason. And I think the students were properly kind of up in arms about it. It doesn't seem quite fair that you should get hooked both ways on the thing. At any rate, I thought it ought to be on the record that I was involved in that. The other thing I wanted to mention to you is something that, can I see the Vita again? Because I can probably date something by that. Was the establishment of the office of the state cartographer in Wisconsin. This goes back to quite a while ago, and I've just got to look through here for a minute and see if I can find a paper that I wrote in that. There we go. Well, this would have been in the early 60s when it began anyway, and I don't remember when it was finally came into fruition, but it probably by 1970 or something like that. There was established by the governor, and I can't remember which one it was now, a series of natural resource committees, one of which was the Committee on State Mapping, which had a representative from the Department of Transportation and the Conservation Department and the University, and which I was, and George not George, yeah, George Hansen of the Wisconsin Geological Natural History Survey. And we were to, as a committee, to recommend to the Natural Resources Committee of state agencies a program for development of the state's mapping. And we had a lot of meetings, and we ended up coming up with three conclusions. One of which was that we ought to promote the mapping of faster than we had been, as topographic mapping. The second was that we ought to make state plane coordinates legal in the state of Wisconsin.
To make what?
State plane, P-L-A-N-E, coordinates. I'll explain that to you later if you'd like. And the third was that we ought to establish an agency called the State Cartographer, or the Office of the State Cartographer. Well, that was my particular baby on the committee, and so it was up to me to carry on with it. Well, for the next several years, I religiously went down to the Capitol and wrote up legislation, or had it drafted, and got somebody to introduce it, and so on. And of course, it kept getting nowhere, because who wants to, they didn't even know what the word meant most of the time. But it so happened that I had a very good friend who was in the legislature. Name was Norman Anderson. I'd known him for some time. And by that time, he was Speaker of the Assembly. And he regularly introduced the bill and pushed it along as best he could. But of course, unless he had enough backing, he could never make it. But I got the backing of the Department of Administration. Finally, through Anderson's actions, it became law. It was established, and for some reason, which I had not recommended or had not even thought of, it was put under the university. This Office of the State Cartographer was put under the university. Of course, the university didn't know anything about what to do with it, and so I was immediately made the chairman of a committee to tell the university what to do about it, and we did, and we interviewed lots and lots and lots of applicants, and we finally selected one, and we have now had a Office of the State Cartographer with a state cartographer and a staff of several for some 10 years or more, and it was one of the first in the United States. And it's since been copied by lots of other states. And it has been an extremely important and useful office, mainly because it doesn't make maps. That's not its function. Its function is to see to it that people who do make maps don't run around in circles doing things that everybody else has already done, facilitating the rather complicated business of map making by knowing where everything is. Mm-hmm. So they have very large files, and they're in close cooperation with the map information, the National Cartographic Information Center, NCIC, in Washington, all of these kinds of things, so that anybody who's making the map in Wisconsin can go to the state cartographer or call them up and say, where is this, and who's doing this, and they know. And it's not very expensive, but there's no question but what it saves the state far more than it costs, just in terms of stopping the duplication. Mm-hmm. And the state cartographer is called upon to do a lot of advisory work and consulting with not just state agencies, but with counties and all of these sorts of things. That's a very important addition to our operations in the state, having to do with map making.
Yeah, I had never thought about
when they started making maps and how they went about it. What was the map-making situation when your committee began?
It wasn't bad, but the trouble is, you see, that map-making is a very complicated, and it's a very sort of situation-specific type operation. That is to say, a conservation department wants a map of something.
Mm.
Now, that's not exactly the same thing as the Department of Agriculture wants, but it's nearly the same.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's stupid for them to go through the whole business of making this great complex map over here and doing 90% of the same stuff over here.
Yeah.
And the purpose of this was to try to stop that kind of duplication, so that if agriculture was doing something, the state cartographer would know about it, and he would tell conservation or DNR
mm-hmm.
that, oh, this is going on over here, why don't you guys get together and cut out a whole lot of this duplication, and it'll save you both money.
Do you know whether they actually did get together?
Oh, yes. Oh, there's no doubt about it.
I mean, often you find that people really don't want to.
Well, there's always a little empire sort of thing involved, but no, they've been quite good about it, because after all, it's money, and they're saving money, this makes quite a bit of difference if you get to the right people.
Mm.
The guys down below maybe don't want to feel that their bailiwick is being invaded, but there's been a lot of cooperation, and the whole thing is overseen by a committee on state cartography, which has representatives from the Department of Administration, the Department of Natural Resources, the Transportation Department, the Geological and Natural History Survey, and 1, 2, 3 from the university.
Now, is that the committee you were on?
No, that's the committee which oversees the operations of the committee of the state cartography.
Oh, so you set that up when you set
yes,
up
the... Yes, we set that up at the same time. So that, you see, there are representatives of the main map-making people on the committee which oversees the state cartographer, and presumably these people are the ones that will know what's going on anyway.
Yeah.
So it's just from that point of view, it's a very, very strong coordinating function. But it really, the whole business of map making has become so complicated and so tied up with computers and satellite imagery and fair photographs and everything else, that you just can't afford not to have some central place where people know what's going on.
Were they already having the plat maps and the, what do you call them, the sectional...
Topographic map?
Mm-hmm. Well, if you buy land, for instance, you can always get a map of that area, or if you're going on a canoe trip, you can always get, what are they called?
Topographic map.
Well, they are topographic, yeah. But there's a term for them, and they'll be particular squares, of, and then you get a series of them, which give you every island and every... little bit of brush and give you
Well, I don't know which ones you're talking about, but they know where they all are. And so if you want to know what's available, all you have to do is pick up telephone call.
But how long has that sort of thing been being done? That's what I was wondering.
I mean,
about.
How old those maps have been made?
All these maps that the public uses, that sort of map.
They go back a long way. Topographic mapping started back in the 19th century.
But I meant specifically Wisconsin making road maps of secondary roads of each county.
Road maps began to be made in Wisconsin by the state in, I think it was 1917.
I see.
Which incidentally was one of the early commissioners said that when he presented the roadmap, you may get stuck in the mud, but at least you'll know where you are. Wisconsin was the first state to number its roads.
Really?
Yeah, but they,
so?
Yeah, mm-hmm. They started about 1917 or 18, something like that. One of my students did a master's thesis on the road map in Wisconsin, and he's got them all the way up to whenever he stopped, for several years ago.
Yeah.
But the road maps have been made ever since, state road maps, and then of course county road maps came along. But there are county maps that are made by counties, and there is the county surveyor, he's got the maps, and all of the municipal engineer has the maps, and there are individual plat maps, and there's just hundreds
of
them.
Plat maps is what I'm thinking.
Yeah, that could be. Yeah, well now, there are two kinds of those. One, you can get copies from the county surveyor of what he's got oftentimes, but then county plat maps are put out commercially, and you can buy them. Most of them are made down in Rockford. It's a matter of
really?
It's surprising. It's just historically interesting as to why it's settled there. But we've had these kinds of things for many, many, many years. All sorts of stuff. For example, the whole state was flown for air photographs about 1938 or something like that. Now, people don't know that, and they're interested in historical stuff. And what was here 20 years ago or 30 years ago or something? The state cartographer's got all that information, and he can tell them.
Yeah.
We had, for example, a state land utilization survey back in the 30s, in which every field in the state of Wisconsin was mapped in terms of what it had on it for the whole state. People don't know about this, but these are great historical records, you see.
Yeah.
And then, of course, with all of the new Hertz photography and Landsat photography and so on, somebody wants that, the state cartographer's office will tell you how to order it, and you can go there and see what's available, and all this sort of thing. They get hundreds and hundreds of calls a month from surveyors and map makers and individuals who are asking, where's this geodetic location, or what's the coordinates of such and such a place, and they're extremely useful. And they put out a bulletin which shows what's being done regularly. And all I can gather is that it's a very, very heavily used and useful organization. And Wisconsin got it started, so to speak.
Do you know why the whatever governor it was got
There was at that time a considerable concern about natural resources and so on. And of course, maps are very important in that. I'm trying to remember.
Might have been Nelson.
I think it probably was Nelson. Yeah. Uh-huh. But I can't remember.
Yeah.
We did direct our reports to the governor or meet with him. We directed them to the Natural Resources Committee of State Agency. Which brings me back to the other two things. One was the promotion of the mapping of the state, which we did our best to get going, and I pushed it up a little bit, and it's pretty near done now. The topographic mapping of the state. And the other was the legalization of state plane coordinates, if you'd like me to give you a short introduction on that. The problem that we have in the United States is that, or in most other places for that matter, is that our land survey system, at least in the public land survey areas, such as Wisconsin, was laid out in this township range section system. And the positions of the corners of all the sections each square mile, is marked on the ground, but it isn't listed in any other way. That is to say, you can't. There's no latitude or longitude to it. You see. In other words, you go there and there's a mark. That's where it is.
But you have to know it's there.
You
somebody
have to know it's there. That's right. Now, there's a great problem in okay, there it is, but how do you tell where it is? I mean, suppose you want to say, well, I'm going to turn my back, and if somebody swipes that mark, how will I know where it was? Because it isn't identified by latitude and longitude, and that's a very difficult thing to do anyway. Because latitude and longitude are very hard to determine precisely for reasons I won't go into. Well, there was developed back in the late 20s and 30s a system that was called state plane coordinates. And this was a rectangular system of which was essentially put on top of a map. Not on the ground, on top of a map. And it was very precisely hooked to known positions in the state, each state. And from those known positions, you could identify by going.
Okay.
This system was developed by the U.S. Coast and Geodetic Survey, now called National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, National Ocean Survey, for each state in the Union. And it is a standard process that's used all over the world now to establish precise position on the ground. And it is extremely important because, as I say, those markers, that's all you got. And when sometimes they were nothing but a blaze on a tree. Well, trees don't last forever. And it's very difficult to recreate. So one of the big problems that is being promoted, incidentally, by the Office of the State Cartographer, is the re-monumentation and listing of all the section corners. Because you can imagine what a mess we'll be in. If you bought the northwest quarter of the southeast quarter of section such and such, and nobody knows where it is.
Now, with sections, you mean 40 acres,
no,
is
no,
that right?
No, sections, 1 square mile.
Oh, I see. 640
acres.
Oh, all right.
Yeah. A quarter section is 160 acres, and a quarter of a quarter is 40 acres. Yeah.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. But they all depend upon positions that were marked on the ground.
When were they first marked on the ground?
Well, this is all of the ones in Wisconsin were done in the 19th century.
Yeah.
Yeah. And all the ones later, farther to the west, were after that. But they were all done in the 19th century. And you can just imagine what a mess you get into with litigation because this guy says he's plowing 10 feet on my land.
Yeah.
How do you know? Markers gone? Yeah. It keeps surveyors in business. But it's so that we recommended that this be made a legal thing in the state of Wisconsin. And it was, and now state plane coordinates are regularly used for all surveys, and ultimately it all gets squared away. It takes quite a while, of course.
Is it something you have to, do you put something at that intersection?
Well, you usually do when you make a survey, you put an iron stake or something.
But it's not a permanent marker.
Well, permanent in the sense that anything is permanent.
But it's intended to be permanent. It's
They'll drive a 4-foot iron stake in the ground, and a guy with a metal detector can go find it.
Yeah.
And stuff like this. But as long as it is specified by state plane coordinates as so many easting, so much easting, and so much northing, from such and such a place, you can always go find it.
Yeah.
No problem.
No.
And it's any surveyor can do it. There's no problem.
Nobody would put a fuss up against establishing the system, would they? It seems pretty sensible.
Yeah, the surveyors, because it cost them effort. All they had to do to survey something was to go out and survey it and pound in the stakes and go away. But if you specified state plane coordinates, then they had to carry the plane coordinates to that point, you see. You can't just go out and say, this is such and such a place. You have to work from a known position.
Yeah, yeah.
And that might be quite a ways away. And this is a headache as far as the surveyor is concerned.
Huh.
So they weren't too happy about it to begin with, but now it's regularly used. And it's a very good thing, and it's going to make our life a lot simpler as time goes on. Cut down on a lot of litigation.
Huh.
Well, at any rate, the Office of the State Cartographer was effectively the first one in the United States that I know of. And now we have them in Colorado and New York and Washington and South Carolina, the ones that I happen to know about, but I know there are a lot more. It's a very important development, I think. Saved a lot of money.
The committee that you were on, how much time did you spend at your working out what you thought ought to be done?
Oh, we met fairly often for about a year or more. I suppose we met probably once a month for an afternoon anyway, but then of course we did a lot of homework prior to that, and then I spent lots of time down at the Capitol getting bills drafted and getting the wording right and getting fiscal summaries, something like that, whatever it is, what's going to cost, the draft dreamed up and so on, and then going and talking to the people in the Department of Administration and getting them to support it and so on.
Did you have any trouble with them?
No. They thought it was a very good idea, but they never wanted to put it in their budget because it looked like they were empire building.
Oh.
And they weren't too willing to support it because it was going to cost some more money. It was only after Norman Anderson got enough support, built up enough support over the years for other things, that he was able to get this one through. But he recognized that it was a very worthwhile thing, because he was strongly interested in conservation and that sort of thing, natural resources. But it was I learned a lot about the workings of state government,
yeah.
And that you can't beat persistence. Now, I really think that if you're persistent, you can get almost anything done.
It's true about everything, isn't it?
Yeah.
Painting or...
mm-hmm. Well, those were the two things that I wanted to mention that we hadn't talked about before. That is to say, the student conduct and appeals in the state cartographer. Can you think of anything else?
Well, I don't know. People are always seem to be interested in the athletic board, and I don't know much about it, but
no.
It seems to be a subject that if
right now especially.
I don't even know enough about it to know why you say that.
Well, because Bill Coalfield just got bounced as basketball coach.
Yes, I did hear about that.
Well, legally he resigned, but that's euphemism. He got bounced and he knew it and so on. If he hadn't resigned, he would have been.
Uh-huh.
Yes, I was on the athletic board for, I really don't know, but it seems like 4, 5, 6 years, something
like
that.
Isn't it rather an honor to be put on the athletic board? How do you get, people like being on it. They get free tickets. Isn't that right?
Yeah, there are a fair number of perquisites. I think I was put on it in order to get me out of the Student Conduct and Appeals Committee, because I was kind of a headache for the administration.
Why were you? Goodness, that's interesting.
Well, I was pushing for a lot of things that the administration didn't want to do. In student conduct, and I didn't think the way we were going about this was fair to the students. I thought it was we were being too arbitrary, I thought the students had a good point. on this, and I argued a good deal about this double jeopardy type thing, and I think that was when Elvium was president, and he called me in one day and asked me would I go on the athletic board. And I said, well, sure, but if you let me off the Student Conduct and Appeals Committee, I will, but not otherwise. And I think that was perhaps what was in mind. The administration were getting a little unhappy with me, because I was, I was just being a... For example, I thought it was quite wrong that the university would discipline somebody for something that they did out in the city of Madison that had no relation whatever with academics. It just seemed to me that it's quite improper for somebody, if he's going to get hooked into the law, if he broke the law, he broke the law. And I didn't see why the university had to do anything about it. And I was pretty vociferous in my pushing on this
thing.
Kind
of committee.
Well,
or
to the committee and to Roy Luberg, who was, I don't know what he was at the time. He was assistant anyway to the president, but I can't remember what his title was. Mm-hmm. But I just thought that we were not doing the right things in the whole conduct policy of the university. And I was glad to get off the committee.
Well, maybe that's what I've heard the criticisms of Zillman might be of that sort of thing.
That could be,
if he determined that kind of policy.
Yeah, I think he's rather championed that attitude. They were pretty. A lot of them were pretty straight-laced type individuals. Oh. Only good people could come to the university, you know, this sort of thing. And I just didn't like it, and I didn't think it was the right thing to do. Well, let's go to the athletic board. That's a very interesting operation, and it's different now than it was then, although I don't think it's greatly different. And I don't want to go on too long about it, but basically the theory of the Western Conference, which is called the Big Ten Conference, is that the faculty has control of athletics. And they do this through the athletic board, which has a majority of voting members are non-athletic people. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know what the situation is now when they've got a lot of student members and stuff like this. I just don't know what's going on. But the academic staff, professors on the board could outvote the non, that is the alumni representative and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And they're basically, they don't have an awful lot to do except to advise and oftentimes do nothing but rubber stamp the activities of the athletic department in approving schedules and ticket prices and all this kind of thing and all of the operations of the athletic board, of the athletic department of intercollegiate athletics, which involves building and operation of the buildings and the construction of the stadia and so on, is all under the athletic board.
Really?
Oh, yes. And the director of athletics can hardly do anything without going to the board. Which I guess is a good thing in general. It's a good idea to have breaks on people. The only time that the athletic board really gets into some awfully fascinating and fancy business is when they're worried about coaches or when they're worried about academics. Then things get a little hot. And because you got the athletic people and the alumni representatives on one side, often, and the faculty on the other side, with a couple of them that are always in the middle.
Yeah.
And we had quite a lot of fuss about the academic side of it when I was on the athletic board. We did surveys of what was going on at other institutions in the Western, in the Big Ten, and we found they were pretty sleazy. And a lot of students, other places, athletes, were taking the theory of play one and the theory of play two and the theory of play three and stuff like this, but doing real well at football. And so we got a little upset occasionally about that. But I would say that my experience on the athletic board is that that as such things go, this at least then, this was a very well-run operation, and that they were quite high-principled people, and they knew what they were supposed to be doing, and that they were a part of the university, and that they weren't supposed to cut corners, and this kind of, and they didn't do things that I thought would have been improper. So I was much impressed. They were pretty good people. There were a lot of things that I didn't like, which were not their fault, but they were the fault of institutional rules, say at Wisconsin, versus rules and regulations of the Big Ten.
Mm-hmm.
That is, the conference has rules. Now they have eligibility rules. We have eligibility rules here at the university. But we also have rules about what you can do from extracurricular activity. And I got into a lot of hot water one time on the athletic board and elsewhere, because I said I didn't think it was right for a person to be able to play football with such and such a grade point average, when if somebody else had that grade point average, he couldn't be a cheerleader. That just didn't seem quite right to me.
Yeah.
That was demeaning to the football player. That caused an awful ruckus on the board one time when I proposed that we follow the regular rule that if you didn't have a C average, you couldn't engage in extracurricular activities. This would have knocked out half the football team.
What had been the rule before that?
Well, the athletic department and the university agrees by being part of the Western Conference,
yes,
to go along with the Western Conference rules of eligibility.
This might be that you could have a D or something.
Yeah. Oh yes. Yeah. Yeah. And it's even worse than that. See, back in those days, you could have the rule was that you had to have a 1 point average, a C average. But the Western Conference, anything over, 4-3-2, a 2 point average. But the Western Conference says anything above anything 1.5 or above counts as a 2.
Well.
you see, this guy. There was this kind of stuff. There were some other things that, but by and large, I was much impressed with the athletic department at that time. Ivy Williamson was the chairman. We went through a couple of coach changes, which was quite an experience. That was a time when we got John Cota as the coach, and almost got Bobby Knight, who's now the coach at Indiana. But he agreed, but then he changed his mind, and so on. But it wasn't a big job, generally. We met once a month for an afternoon.
Well, that is very light, isn't it?
Relatively speaking, yes. Only you had a little committee activity, subcommittee activity over and above that, but not very much. But when you were going into a coaching change, and that was a lot, as you were meeting every night for a week or two, interviewing people and so on, but it was a... It was an interesting experience, and I would say, as far as I could tell, with the exception of Ohio State, I think probably Wisconsin is about as high class as any place.
I was going to ask you, who came out?
Yeah, we had no complaint with Ohio State at all, Although we always get beat by Ohio State, almost always in football. I remember I asked the people one time, quite apart from that, I said, in terms of your relationships and so on, who's the best, what's the best outfit to deal with in the conference? Oh, I said Ohio State, no question about it. They're the class outfit. But some of the others were pretty bad. Some of the things they were doing to let students in there that just you wouldn't believe. It's how they got away with it, I don't know.
Do you have reason to think that was because of a particular person in charge of things and that would change?
Well, it would be bound to change, although unless things got so bad that it created an awful mess, and they threw everybody out and started over again, you wouldn't change things much. As long as they were getting along and what they were doing, they'd keep going.
So you think Wisconsin's still pretty near the top?
I would think so, yes. I don't think there's any doubt about it. That's I haven't been close to it now for years, and so I can't. But I read the newspapers and sports pages regularly, I see nothing to suggest that it's any different. I think we're a good outfit.
You'd have to be interested, like athletics, to be on the board, because if you were a purely academic person, you might say, well, I think they all ought to have C's or maybe even B's in order to play football.
Well, you can say it, but it wouldn't do you any good, because you're part of the conference, you see. Mm. You really ought to have some interest or knowledge of athletics. You don't have to have much. You don't have to be eating and drinking it all the time. Mm. Just as there are lots and lots of committees that people get put on, and it's better if they know something about what the subject is. Same is true of athletics.
Yeah.
You have to be realistic. It's a big business, and it's getting bigger all the time. And the athletic department, the intercollegiate department of intercollegiate athletics, is a self-sustaining organization.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't get any money from anywhere, except what it gets in the way of contributions and takes in gate receipts. You have to remember that it doesn't have anything to fall back on. So they have to make money if they're going to stay in business. And of course, they love to stay in business because that's what pays their salaries.
Yeah, it's a good incentive.
You can't go into being on the athletic board with a starry eye about what the world ought to be like. You have to realize what it is like.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to keep it the way within bounds. My own view is that we'd all be better off if we didn't have it. It didn't seem to me that it hurt Chicago in the slightest. when they got rid of big-time athletics. And I don't think it would hurt the University of Wisconsin at all, or any of the other universities. But they'd love to tell you that it would. I remember listening to some big shot in the university saying at one time, one meeting we had somewhere, I can't remember what it was now, rather big formal meeting, that it was extremely important to have a good football team because it brought a lot to the university. It increased our prestige with the legislature, blah, 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 blah. And that year we went to the Rose Bowl. Very good game. Oh. Next year we got the worst cut we've ever had.
Oh, that's
so it doesn't work. Yeah. I just don't think we'd be any better, any worse off if we didn't have athletics. But there are an awful lot of people that like them, and why not, I guess, as long as they keep them under control. And I think they're well under control here. So I have no complaint about them. I don't go to football games anymore.
Just realizing all the women's colleges get along without intercollegiate athletics.
Well, not so much anymore.
Well, they did.
Yeah, but now women are just, they're mandated by federal law. The program has to be just as much for women as for men.
Well, yes, in the university. I was thinking of the women's colleges.
Well, but I'll bet you they're doing it too.
Maybe.
I wouldn't doubt it a bit. I'll bet they're strong in basketball and hockey, and I mean field hockey and things like this. I'll bet you.
I'll have to check. I'd like to ask you a couple of questions that I've decided to ask people that I interview, which is in view of somebody listening to these, if it's a long time from now. One is whether you think the discipline of geography as it is now is what it should be, whether it may change very much, and the other is what you think of as the most serious problem facing the world today.
Oh boy.
But you can answer with a word if you wish.
Well, let's look at the first one, the geography. I think the biggest problem with geography is one of I guess you could call it sort of self-esteem. I think they're very apologetic, and they've been put in that position sort of historically. I don't find historians are apologetic. But there isn't the slightest bit of difference between an historian and a geographer, except that one of them is looking at things from a spatial point of view and the other one's looking at it from a chronological point of view. Everything is interrelated, and it's a good idea to know how they're interrelated, and whether it's spatial or chronological doesn't make much difference. But geographers have a strong tendency to be shy. They don't get out and push themselves at all. This I've noticed ever since I got into the field of geography. I grew up as a historian, that was my major in college, and my father was an historian, and so on and so on. And so I've always kind of looked at geography as partly from the outside, seeing what's going on as a field. And it's a widely diffuse field, and there's just almost anything under the sun that can be looked at geographically as it can historically.
Do you think something might come along the way, psychoanalysis or the discovery of evolution or something might come along that would change what a geographer thought the field was about?
Oh, I don't think so, no. I think that you have to go and know something of the history of the subject before I could get very go very far into this, but up until I would say the latter part of the, or the middle part of the 19th century, geography was mostly new places, and discovery, exploration, all this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And there was plenty of it. There was a lot going on. And it was fascinating, and people were very much interested in it. And the schools were full of geography, and you just automatically took geography. Well, they began after an awful lot of everything was discovered, so to speak, and explored. Then geographers began to go off into very separate areas, and new fields developed, which had previously been handled by the geographer. Mm-hmm. And so we often have called geography the mother of sciences, because after so long a time, geology split off. And then right here, meteorology split off. And we've got these kinds of things going on all the time. And so one has the, one in looking at the field from a historical point of view, you keep seeing that it keeps throwing things off. So what's left, you see? And so I really think they tend to be rather apologetic about this. But plus the fact that about the end of last century or the first part of this century, the school systems in this country began to discard geography as a separate area of study in grade schools and high schools, mm-hmm. and substituted what they called social science, and oftentimes history as well. So they began to have less, the word had less of a meaning, and oftentimes what was taught as geography was awful rote memorization junk. Just as in history, you get sometimes terrible nothing but dates, and who was the ruler of what, you know, and stuff like that. Well, you get Maine, Augusta on the Kennebec River, and you just list the whole thing.
The products of Brazil.
Yeah, it's terrible stuff. And the whole combination has kind of lowered the whole thought of what geography is. Well,